Gaydar. You've heard the term. What about the science? There may actually be subconscious cues that clue you into a person's sexuality. A biological radar for gay people. Sounds like fiction, but wait till you hear some of these facts. David France is a contributing editor to New York Magazine and recently culled all that science has to offer on gaydar. We'd of course like to hear from you on this. We'd especially like to hear from our gay listeners. Do you think that the traits associated with homosexuality are scientific? Learned? Are we just reinforcing a stereotype? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Don't forget our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining me from Argo Network in New York City is David France. His article in New York Magazine is called The Science of Gaydar. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's nice to be with you, Andrea.
So let me start with this. You write in your story that you're gay, and though you don't think of yourself as particularly gay acting or straight acting, for that matter, people can often tell. Is that the sort of thing that started your quest for science?
Well, some of these scientific findings have been percolating up in the newspaper and the radio over the last couple of years. It occurred to me that there might be we might be reaching some sort of consensus on some of these things. And in fact, that's what I discovered as I poked into it.
What did you find?
Well, the first of these findings, of course, is about 15 years old, and that's that that the gay male brain has some distinct anatomical variations to it that makes it different from the straight male brain and more, in fact, similar to the straight female brain. And that has to do primarily with a section of the brain called the hypothalamus and a small nucleus resting on the hypothalamus. But since then, they've discovered certain kind of characteristics and traits about gay people that seem to suggest that in many different ways we're presenting this kind of face to the world that is slightly different. One, for example, is the relationship in length between your index finger and your ring finger. Now, for most men, the index finger is shorter than the ring finger. And for most women, the index finger is about the same length or maybe even a little longer. They have discovered that statistically...
I hear the radio world looking at its hands right now, by the way.
You should be studying your hand, but especially your right hand, because this is most pronounced on your right hand for some reason.
So say it again.
Your index finger, for most men, is shorter than your ring finger. So if you look at your hand from the palm at that relationship, I think most men will see that their index finger is a little shorter than their ring finger and that most women will see that their index finger is closer in length or maybe even a little longer. That relationship is reversed in many gay people, not in all gay people, and it's not in straight people always in that ratio. It's just one of the statistical findings that they've found that suggests that there might be some difference here. Another one, harder to picture, is that most women and most men have a different ridge count on their fingerprints, on their thumb and pinky of their left hand. Women's
meaning
the
they
density,
have more.
The density for women is much greater than it is for men. But gay men have a left hand that's a lot like a straight woman's hand. The way men and women hear is technically different, and lesbians hear more like straight men than they hear like straight women. So it's just kind of an accumulation of these things that's really becoming a kind of a fascinating bundle of findings.
Now this is scientifically, let me ask you, my index finger is shorter than my ring finger, and I'm not gay, at least I don't think so. And so tell me what science says and what it doesn't say about my index finger. This is not a causal effect, in other words.
Right, exactly. In fact, the interesting aspect of these findings is that, A, it's a statistical relationship that they're associating with sexual orientation here. Hmm. But, B, it seems to be suggesting that there's not a simple range between masculine and feminine, that it's, in fact, much more of a matrix of characteristics and traits that would suggest that there are several varieties of heterosexualities, for example, and several varieties of homosexualities, and that we all have varying avenues that bring us to our sexual orientation. And those, depending on which avenue we took, will impact various aspects of our physicality.
And you said something, you said that lesbian women hear like straight men. What do you mean?
Well, this is a relatively recent finding, but that women and men hear in a technically different way, and it has to do with the emission of sounds from the ear canal. It's a pretty linear, it's pretty divided finding between men and women, although some men will hear like women and some women will hear like men. But statistically, lesbians are much more likely to hear with the same mechanism that men use for hearing. And gay men don't hear more like women. They hear still like men. So there's a suggestion that this is only something that affects lesbians. Again, we don't know what causes it. We just know that there's a statistical connection there.
Tell me about the science, David France. What are your findings based on?
Well, there's a small kind of coterie of researchers who are working in this field, many of them gay and lesbian, often working privately, often working with out-of-university laboratories with very little financing because there's not much appetite to finance studies of this sort. And they begin with observations, and they're testing these observations. Most of these studies have very small population sizes, and some of them are contradicted by other findings. But all of them seem to be pointing to the notion that, and I think these scientists would make this statement, that there's an approaching scientific consensus that sexual orientation is inborn, meaning that it's something that's biologically created in utero. Hmm. And that's what would point to the unique constellation of these physical findings, all of which are mediated somehow during gestation. So that's why they're thinking if there's a relationship between these findings and homosexuality or heterosexuality, that they must all be taking place at about the same time.
Let's let the listeners in on this conversation. Jamie in Ann Arbor, Michigan, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
It's a pleasure.
I just wanted to make a comment. You were talking earlier about whether, you know, people think it's a biological basis or a learned sort of behaviors that gay people have, gaydar. I myself am gay, and I firmly believe that I think it is learned, and my reasoning is that if you grow up in an environment, especially in one where you're forced to be closeted or not be able to be yourself completely, that you are sort of very aware of these certain behaviors that might give you away, and that could lead to just being more aware of these behaviors in other people, kind of like if you're a chef, you're just more aware of better quality foods or whatnot.
But Jamie, let me ask you, how does it make you feel as a gay man listening to this to hear that there may be biological elements to this?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that there is. I just graduated from the University of Michigan, actually, in neuroscience, and I did my I worked in a lab that studied sexual behavior in sheep who were prenatally treated with different hormones.
Hmm.
And so I definitely do agree that there is a biological basis for sexual orientation. Do I think it's completely biological? Absolutely not. I think a lot of it is learned. I don't know the ratio. But as far as gaydar itself goes, I don't think there's a biological predisposition to recognizing somebody else's homosexuality.
Jamie, thank you so much for your call. David France, what do you think?
Well, one of the interesting upshoots, I guess, from this line of work is the suggestion that gaydar is not something that is a skill of the viewer, but says more about the viewed. And it's not entirely, as Jamie was talking about, behaviors which can be altered and restricted or made more pronounced. What they're suggesting is that there are visual clues that have to do with kind of anatomies that are noticeable.
Tell us about the hair whirl. That was fascinating.
Well, in the ordinary population, in the general population, some 8% of heads have a counterclockwise hair whirl.
We're talking about the sort of cowlick at the top of
exactly.
your hair.
It turns out that they go one way or another. I hadn't realized that before now, but that that gay people are 3 or 4 times more likely to have a counterclockwise whirl. And we know this from 2 studies so far that have been conducted among men. We don't know what the parallel is among women because even in lesbian populations, the hair lengths are too long to be able to determine the kind of the ideal Rorschach, if you will, for a hair wool study is a crew cut. And so they've been able to manage these studies among men more simply than among women. Hmm. But that's a suggestion. Left-handedness, for example. Gays and lesbians are 50% more likely to be left-handed than right-handed. And these things seem to be suggesting a kind of a visual portrait. Gay men's arms, legs, and hands are smaller in relationship to their torso. And lesbians' limbs are longer in relationship to their torso than the general population.
Now,
these things may be visibly apparent to people who are paying attention.
But let's make it clear one more time that if your fingers are as mine are, your index finger is shorter than your ring finger and your whorl goes the wrong way, it doesn't necessarily mean you are gay.
Right, nor does it mean that you're straight if you don't have those things. Mm. We do know, and Jamie pointed this out, that some 50% of homosexuality is, and actually sexual orientation, gayness and straightness, is believed to be genetically predisposed. What scientists had not understood until now, and they're just developing this understanding, is what acts on that biological base to make people gay. You know, if it's not just genes itself, what else is happening? And these other kind of secondary and tertiary sexual characteristics are suggestive of some sort of in utero activity that seems to be somehow mediating this development.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go back to the phones for one more call. Let's talk to Ken in Sunnyvale, California. Do we have you? Ken in Sunnyvale? Oh, we missed him. Let's go ahead to Andrew in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Andrea.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. Go ahead with your question.
I have more of a comment than a question, I guess, as a gay male as well. When your guest came on and when your first caller came on, I immediately knew that they were gay by the tone of their voice and the inflections in their voice. And I was wondering if there was any study or anything that had been done dealing with that issue.
David France?
Yes, there is, in fact. There's a series of studies all by the same researcher in which he's played tapes to audiences and asked the audience to say whether or not the person reading this prescribed text into the tape was gay or straight. And 75% of an audience can select a gay voice, can accurately select a gay voice. And that would suggest that there is something to the gay voice. Now, there has been no research that I've been able to discover so far that would look into whether or not there's something, for example, to the theory that there's a gay accent or that there's a gay vocal cord. For example, we might have some sort of timbre that's somehow apparent to the listener. But the researchers actually believe that it's some combination of those things that is somehow creating what might actually be the gay voice. And, you know, I was thinking as I was piecing together some of this research that that you can hear that in celebrities' voices, and you wonder whether or not you're hearing something that they've kind of amplified and made more apparent, or is it something that they're born with?
Jonathan in East Lansing, Michigan. Go ahead.
I guess today is a Michigan day for all your callers. My question actually is, you just talked about the gay tone of voice or whatnot, and in my opinion, all it takes is one trip to Europe to realize that what we think of our own gaydar is just a regional gaydar, and I'm curious if you had any insight into regional attributes of what we think of being gaydar.
Fascinating question, Jonathan. Go ahead, David Fran.
I was able to find only one study that looked kind of across cultures. There certainly are some European studies that have been echoing a lot of these findings. But I was looking for studies outside of the West, and I found only one, and it has not to do with gaydar, that is, the signals that gay people give off, so much as the position of gay people in their communities. And there's a large BBC internet survey that some scientists have now gone back and kind of reanalyzed based on the slices of sexual orientation. And they've discovered that across 53 countries, gay people are considerably more likely to be involved in creative employment pursuits than straight people. And that was kind of an interesting finding. That would suggest that that maybe there's not just a kind of a gay presence in the world, but a gay cognitive or kind of function of one's creative involvements. Hmm. And that was interesting. And of course, you could say that maybe these creative fields are the only ones that allow gay people to work in them, especially outside of Western cultures. So there's still a lot of studying that has to be brought to bear to that question.
When you set out to write an article like this, do you worry about contributing to the social stereotypes that surround sexual orientation?
It's interesting, especially in this area, because that's what is being researched, are the stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Is there a foundation for these stereotypes? And I was not so worried about contributing to that personally, but I was interested to know what science was doing in that area. And I was surprised, actually, to find out that not only were they taking stereotypes seriously, but in many cases, they were codifying them.
Setting them in stone of some sort, scientific stone.
Proving them. Interesting.
David France is a contributing editor to New York Magazine. He joined us from the Argo Network in New York City. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can read his article, The Science of Gaydar, on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Conan is back tomorrow. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington.